Letter of Intent. One of the first things that anyone should learn about real estate, and New York real estate in particular, is never to sign a letter of intent. Years can be spent in court trying to get out of a seemingly simple and non-binding agreement. Macri did not fully realize this, and in addition, my lawyer, Jerry Schrager, drafted a letter of intent that was significantly more binding than most. It was with an eye to getting this letter signed that Jerry and I sat down in mid-1984 in an extraordinary apartment at the Sherry Netherland Hotel, along with Macri, his young son, and a beautiful interpreter named Christina. She was a true Latin beauty, and all of us were somewhat distracted. I'll never forget Christina's stopping in the middle of translating a complex legal point and saying to Macri, "You really should get a lawyer to help you understand the meaning of this document. It's very complicated." "No, no, Christina," he said. "As long as I can get out of it, it's not so important." And he went ahead and signed. As it turned out, Macri retained his dream of proceeding with the project, and several months later he called and asked me to let him rescind his letter of intent. I declined, but he asked if we could meet, and I agreed. Macri explained that the project was killing him, but that he desperately wanted to make one last effort to get his financing and move forward. I couldn't help feeling sympathetic, having spent years myself working to launch difficult projects. I also appreciated his openness. I took the letter of intent out of a folder and tore it in two, in front of Macri. And then I said to him, "If you should ever again decide to sell, I hope you'll think of me first. In the meantime, good luck." When I told Schrager what I'd done, he wasn't happy. But to this day, I'm convinced that my ripping up that letter, which may or may not have been binding, is the reason that Macri did come back to me, instead of going to any of a dozen other potential bidders, when it finally became clear that he couldn't get his financing after all. Even before I signed the purchase papers in January 1985, I had the basic elements of my plan in mind. I intended to build many fewer buildings than Macri, and all along a single block. Views were the site's single strongest selling point, and I wanted every apartment to have unobstructed views either of the Hudson River to the west, the extraordinary cityscape to the east, or both. I also intended to build much taller buildings than Macri had planned, to take full advantage of the views, and also because I believed tall buildings would make the project more majestic and alluring. I also envisioned a huge retail shopping promenade on the ground level, along the riverfront in front of the buildings. What the Upper West Side of Manhattan needs more than anything else, I believe, is basic shopping services, large supermarkets, shoe stores, pharmacies, and hardware stores. Rents along Broadway, Amsterdam Avenue, and Columbus Avenue have gotten so high that small shopkeepers have been driven out. It's easier today to find a $100 pair of leather gloves on Columbus Avenue than a loaf of bread. One advantage of my low land cost is that I will be able to charge more reasonable rents to retail tenants. My plans were contingent, of course, on what sort of zoning I could get. I didn't have to undertake complex cost analyses to know that the only way to make the project feasible was to get approval for many more units and total square feet of buildable space than Macri got. Unlike Macri, I was prepared to hold out for as long as it took, even into another city administration if necessary, to win approval for a plan I believe can be economically workable. My first goal was to put as much distance as possible between Macri's approved project and my own vision for the site. Any link to his project could only hurt me. At the time he sold to me, Macri had yet to sign any formal contract with the city, and the city had yet to issue him a final building permit. I was under no obligation, therefore, to deliver on his many promises. Starting the process over from scratch meant I'd have to spend much more time and money, but I felt there was no other choice. My first critical challenge was to make the project exciting and attractive to the city, so that they'd be inclined to give me the zoning approvals I needed. The key was to find a mutual interest. Deals work best when each side gets something it wants from the other. By luck, I picked up the newspaper one morning, soon after purchasing the site, and the answer came to me. It turned out that NBC, which had long had headquarters in Rockefeller Center, was looking to relocate. Edward S. Gordon, a top New York real estate broker, then confirmed this to me. Among the possibilities NBC had in mind was a move across the river to New Jersey, where they stood to save considerable money by virtue of that state's lower taxes and land costs. For the city to lose any large company is obviously bad, but there could hardly be a worse blow than losing NBC. Pure economics are part of the issue. The city's Economic Development Agency has estimated that if NBC moves, it will cost New York some 4,000 jobs and perhaps $500 million a year in revenues. The psychological loss would be at least as great. It's one thing to lose a manufacturing company no one has ever heard of. It's another to lose a company that is a crucial part of what makes New York the media capital of the world. The two other networks, ABC and CBS, now produce nearly all their programs in Los Angeles. NBC still does the Today Show, the NBC Nightly News, Late Night with David Letterman, The Cosby Show, Saturday Night Live, and other shows from New York. You can't put a specific dollar value on the excitement and glamour of being home to the number one network and its top-rated shows. It's like trying to assess what New York would be like without the Empire State Building or the Statue of Liberty. With the West Side Yards, I had something to offer NBC that no other New York developer could possibly match. Enough space to build huge single-story studios in the style of Hollywood backlots. NBC was making do at Rockefeller Center with a cramped 1.2 million square feet of space. On my site, I could offer them 2 million square feet, as well as room for future expansion, and I'd still have plenty of room left over to build the rest of the project I had in mind. In addition, because my land costs had been so low, I was in a position to offer NBC a price per square foot far below what they might otherwise get in New York. Even at that, to be truly competitive with a New Jersey offer, I knew I'd need a tax abatement from the city. But I also knew that it was in the city's economic interest to provide incentives for NBC to stay. The more I thought about it, the better I liked the idea. Even if NBC ultimately decided not to move to my site, it was still a perfect place to build television and motion picture studios. With or without NBC, I felt studios would be a good, high-profile business. Before I got a commitment from the network, I decided to design my project around the studio concept. The first step was a name, Television City. My second challenge was to find a way to immediately capture the public imagination with my project. The more awareness and excitement I could create early on, the easier it was going to be to attract buyers down the line. A lot of developers build first and promote later, if at all. The world's tallest building was a project I considered undertaking even before I purchased the West Side Yards. I've always loved very tall buildings. I remember coming in from Brooklyn as a kid with my father and pleading with him to take us to see the Empire State Building, which at the time was the world's tallest building. But then Chicago built the Sears Tower and took away the title. I loved the challenge of bringing the world's tallest building back to New York, where I felt it really belonged. In a way, I saw the building as a loss leader. When you build any structure higher than about 50 stories, the construction costs escalate geometrically. If maximum profit is your sole motive, you're far better off putting up three 50-story towers than one 150-story skyscraper. On the other hand, I felt the building would ultimately pay for itself as a tourist attraction and an overall lure. After all, how many millions of tourists have come, as I once did, to see the Empire State Building? The next challenge was to find an architect who was as enthusiastic as I was about making such a building the centerpiece of this project. In the end, I interviewed only two architects. The first was Richard Meyer, who represents the epitome of the New York architectural establishment. Critics adore Meyer, and he has a big following. But what I discovered very quickly is that Meyer is not the sort of guy who jumps in with great energy and enthusiasm. He prefers to spend time pondering and analyzing and theorizing. For weeks, I waited for him to bring me a scale model of a plan, or at least some preliminary drawings. Nothing came. In the meantime, I also met with Helmut Jahn. I liked him for very different reasons than I liked Meyer. Jahn was an outsider, German-born, Chicago-based, in no way part of the New York architectural establishment. He was a bit of a dandy personally, a very good promoter, and he'd gotten very good notices for some very daring work. Among other things, Jahn designed the Xerox Center in downtown Chicago and the high-tech State of Illinois building. At the time I talked with him, he had four major buildings underway in Midtown Manhattan. What I liked most about Helmut was that he believed, as I did, that big can be beautiful. He liked spectacle. Less than 3 weeks after we first talked, he arrived in my office with a scale model of a project that incorporated the basic elements I told him I wanted, as well as several of his own. In the summer of 1985, I hired Jahn to be the project's chief architect. By the fall, we'd batted back and forth a dozen possible designs for the site. Both of us felt that the site was so big and so distinctive that it made no sense to try to create something that blended into the surrounding community. Instead, we saw this as a chance to build a self-contained city with a look and a character wholly distinct from the disparate surrounding neighborhoods. On November 18th, we held a press conference to announce our plan for the site. For years, while Macri pursued his Lincoln West plan, the media had ignored him. This time, no fewer than 50 reporters, local and national, showed up for our announcement. I ran down the basic elements. We were calling it Television City, and we hoped to lure NBC as our prime tenant. We intended to build a mixed-use development totaling 18.5 million square feet of commercial, residential, and retail space. The project would include approximately 8,000 residential units, 3.5 million square feet of TV and motion picture studios and offices, 1.7 million square feet of retail space, 8,500 parking spaces, and almost 40 acres of parks and open space, including a 13-block waterfront promenade. At the center of the site, we'd erect the world's tallest building, 1,670 feet high, or about 200 feet higher than the Sears Tower in Chicago. To me, the beauty of the plan was its simplicity and its grandeur. In addition to the world's tallest building, we'd put up just seven other buildings, three at the north end, four at the south. A decked over three-level platform in front of the buildings, including parking and enclosed shopping, would permit us to put a pedestrian promenade on top, at a level slightly higher than the adjacent West Side Highway. The result would be to provide an unimpeded view of the river from virtually any spot on the site. We'd also have enormous space for parks. In all, our proposal was about 50% bigger than Macri's. But even at that, the overall density was lower than that of many smaller developments squeezed onto tiny midtown sites. Most reporters, I find, have very little interest in exploring the substance of a detailed proposal for a development. They look instead for the sensational angle. In this case, that may have worked to my advantage. I was prepared for questions about density and traffic and the mix of housing on the site. But instead, all the reporters wanted to talk about was the world's tallest building. It gave the project an instant mystique. When I got home that night, I switched on the CBS Evening News, expecting to hear news from the opening of the summit between Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev. Dan Rather was in Geneva anchoring the program, but after summarizing the day's developments, suddenly he was saying, "In New York City today, developer Donald Trump announced plans to build the world's tallest building." It demonstrated how powerful and intoxicating a symbol I'd found for my project. The reaction to the world's tallest building was hardly uniformly positive, but I fully expected that. The controversy actually helped keep the project in the news. Critics insisted that such a building was unnecessary, that people wouldn't want to live up so high, and that I'd never be able to build it anyway. Newsweek did a full-page story about the building, headlined Donald Trump's Lofty Ambition. The New York Times ran an editorial about my plan, which probably added to its credibility. Time alone, the editorial said, can distinguish between great dreams and vain illusions. It's too early to know which describes Donald Trump's desire to loom over New York and all other cityscapes with a 150-story tower. My favorite reaction to the world's tallest building came from columnist George Will. I've always liked Will, in part because he's not afraid to challenge fashion. "Donald Trump is not being reasonable," Will wrote. "But then, man does not live by reason alone, fortunately. Trump, who believes that excess can be a virtue, is as American as Manhattan's skyline, which expresses the Republic's erupting energies. He says the super skyscraper is necessary because it is unnecessary. He believes architectural exuberance is good for us, and he may have a point. Brashness, zest, and elan are part of this country's character." My only regret was that George Will didn't have a seat on the City Planning Commission. To my surprise, as time passed, opposition to the world's tallest building seemed to diminish. Critics focused instead on other aspects of the development, which I'd expected to be less controversial. In particular, the Times architecture critic, Paul Goldberger, launched something of a crusade against Television City. A week after I announced my plans, Goldberger wrote a long piece entitled, "Is Trump's Latest Proposal Just a Castle in the Air?" His major criticism, aside from the fact that he simply doesn't like tall buildings, was that the project hadn't been sufficiently integrated into the rest of the neighborhood. That, of course, was precisely what I liked best about it. The worst thing I could do, I was convinced, was to build something that blended into the surroundings. 10 years earlier, I'd taken the same position on the rebuilding of the Commodore Hyatt Hotel. The Grand Central neighborhood was dying, and I felt the only chance at success was to build a spectacular new hotel sheathed in reflective glass, so that it stood apart from the dull, older buildings in the neighborhood. The hotel became an enormous success, and eventually even the critics came around. Reading Goldberger, I felt I was reliving the Commodore experience. I felt certain I'd get far better reviews from Paul Goldberger and certain other critics simply by cutting my buildings in half and making them look more like the better-known pre-war buildings on the West Side. The problem was that my project would no longer be majestic or distinctive, and it wouldn't sell. It irritates me that critics, who've neither designed nor built anything themselves, are given carte blanche to express their views in the pages of major publications, whereas the targets of their criticism are almost never offered space to respond. Of course, I can be irritated all I want and it won't do any good. So long as a critic writes for a newspaper like the New York Times, his opinion will continue to carry great weight, whether I like it or not. By the spring of 1986, the project we'd proposed was at something of a standstill with city planning. Much of the explanation was that city government itself had become almost completely paralyzed under the mayoral administration of Ed Koch. Koch has achieved something quite miraculous. He's presided over an administration that is both pervasively corrupt and totally incompetent. Richard Daley, the former mayor of Chicago, managed to survive corruption scandals because at least he seemed able to operate his city efficiently. Under Koch, the problem of the homeless has grown far worse. The vast majority of the city remains unwired for cable. Highways have gone unrepaired. Subway tunnels have been left unfinished. Companies have continued to flee to other cities, and city services have deteriorated inexorably. Meanwhile, no fewer than a dozen Koch appointees and cohorts have been indicted on charges of bribery, perjury, and accepting kickbacks, or have been forced to resign in disgrace after admitting various ethical transgressions. The criminally indicted include Jay Turoff, the former head of the Taxi and Limousine Commission, John McLaughlin, the hospital's chief, and Anthony Amoruso, the former transportation commissioner. Victor Botnick, one of Koch's closest personal advisors, quit after it was revealed that he'd lied about his educational background and had taken numerous unnecessary trips under the pretext of doing city business. Bess Meyerson, the cultural affairs commissioner and one of Koch's best friends, resigned in disgrace and was eventually indicted after it came out that she'd given a job to the daughter of a judge she was seeking to influence and had then lied repeatedly about her involvement. Later it came out that Koch ignored evidence that Meyerson had acted improperly. The irony is that Koch made his reputation by boasting about his integrity and incorruptibility. It doesn't seem to occur to him that if the people he appoints prove to be corrupt, then in the end, he must take the responsibility. To the contrary, at the first hint that any of his friends might be in trouble, Koch can't run fast enough the other way. For example, when his close friend Donald Maines, the late Queens Borough president, came under investigation and tried to commit suicide, Koch immediately called him a crook, even though Maines had yet to be indicted for anything. At the time, Maines was recovering in a hospital. Weeks later, he did succeed in killing himself. As for the Koch appointees who managed to avoid criminal indictment, the scandal is their sheer incompetence. Many just lack talent. Others seem to have concluded that the safest approach to protecting their jobs is to stop making decisions of any kind. At least then they can't be accused of breaking the law. The problem is that when officials in a huge city government stop making decisions, you get the bureaucratic equivalent of gridlock. Dishonesty is intolerable, but inaction and incompetence can be every bit as bad. In any case, the city was also stonewalling my project as a means of trying to force me to make changes. In my view, it was a form of economic blackmail. So long as I resisted their ideas, they held up my approvals, and my costs mounted. Specifically, city planning wanted me to provide more direct access to the waterfront, add more east-west streets connecting the project to the existing city street grid, and move the world's tallest building south, away from the existing residential neighborhoods. I disagreed with their suggestions, but I also recognized that zoning is always a matter of negotiation. As hard as I push, in the end, I'm practical. If it took making some compromises to get the project moving forward, and the result didn't undermine the project's economic viability, I was prepared to make the changes. In March, I decided to move the location of the world's tallest building south to 63rd Street. The people at city planning were immediately more enthusiastic. Around the same time, the New York Times had made public an environmental impact study of the site. Some of its conclusions, I felt, would ultimately help my cause. I'd always believed that any concerns about density were unwarranted. In truth, the west side of Manhattan is relatively underpopulated. According to the census, the area declined in population from 245,000 in 1960 to 204,000 in 1980. Only 3,100 new apartments went up in the neighborhood between 1980 and 1984. Adding several thousand more hardly represents development run amok. The study also pointed out several benefits that would come from the project. For example, the study predicted that the West Side would gain business worth at least $500 million a year from new residents, as well as tens of thousands of jobs, both during construction and permanently on the site. Providing jobs, in my view, is a far more constructive solution to unemployment than creating welfare programs. Finally, the study found that any added vehicular congestion in the area, a major concern among some critics, could be eased by improvements in local subways and the addition of a jitney service, which I'd already proposed. Even after moving the location of the world's tallest building, I began to believe that I might also have to make a change in architects. I liked the fact that Helmut Jahn was an outsider, but I think it hurt us with the people at city planning. No one at the commission ever seemed quite comfortable with Helmut. It was never anything more specific than that, but in the end, I felt that was enough. If the project was going to move forward, there had to be some spirit of cooperation. Reluctantly, I decided to make a change. A lot of people were surprised that I chose Alex Cooper. Even more than Richard Meyer, Cooper was Jan's antithesis. Legendarily civic-minded, he'd built his reputation as an urban planner, served 5 years on the City Planning Commission, and helped write the rules of the planning process I was now going through. Along with his partner at the time, Stanton Ekstedt, Cooper had just finished work on the master plan for a development at the southern tip of Manhattan called Battery Park. The critics loved it, calling it a classic example of enlightened urban architecture. I wasn't a total fan of the Battery Park project myself. For example, while the project was situated on the waterfront, many of its apartments faced other buildings, and therefore had no water views at all. In addition, I felt that a number of the buildings were totally undistinguished architecturally. However, Cooper's contributions to the master plan, the placement of streets, parks, and other amenities, I did like, and I felt he could bring some of those ideas to our site. I had first interviewed Cooper in October 1985, shortly before going public with the Helmut Jahn plan for the site. There were already indications that the city might have problems with the way we'd designed our open space, and I was interested in hiring Cooper to work with Jahn just on that. Working together didn't appeal to either of them, however, so I put the idea on the back burner. I called Cooper again in May 1986 and offered him the chance to take over sole responsibility for the Television City job. In my opinion, he was the guy best positioned to get my project moving forward. As for him, although we might have been on different sides of the fence in the past, what smart, ambitious architect could pass up such an opportunity? Television City was probably the best and most challenging design job available anywhere. It was about time, I challenged Alex, that he got associated with something big and bold instead of small and precious. To his credit, Alex jumped at the opportunity. "My God," he told a reporter later, "it's 3/4 of a mile of Hudson frontage, so you don't likely just walk away." We had our differences, but I quickly discovered that Alex had far grander instincts than many people realized, and we got along better professionally than most people assumed we would. Alex added more streets and pedestrian walkways, providing direct access through the project to the waterfront. He designed parks that were easily reached by anyone coming from outside. We agreed to increase the number of buildings and to make each one a little smaller. In front of the taller buildings, Alex added townhouses as a way of varying the scale. What Alex didn't do was substantially reduce the amount of overall square footage below what I believe was necessary to ensure the project's economic viability. Still, his changes plainly had an impact. Suddenly, we started getting more positive feedback from city planning. When we unveiled the plan publicly on October 23, 1986, even our toughest critics were more enthusiastic than they'd been about the original plan. The head of the local community board, John Kowal, still objected to the super skyscraper, but he described Alex's new approach as a brilliant answer to Trump's desires and a far better plan. Cooper himself, who'd been skeptical of the size of the project at first, grew more enthusiastic as he got more involved in the design. In April 1987, he told the New York Times, "I hope that the project can be dealt with on its merits. The problem is that the anti-development spirit in this city is very, very strong right now. What we are trying to do with Television City is different. There is room by the river, and we are providing a level of public amenity that makes this immense size justifiable. Parks, waterfront promenades, and so forth. The world's tallest building demands an extraordinary situation. But if there is any place that such a skyscraper makes sense, it is here. I couldn't have said it better myself. As for attracting NBC to the site, I felt our cause got a boost when General Electric purchased RCA, owner of NBC, in mid-1986. I knew Jack Welch, Jr., the chairman of GE, and he struck me as a brilliant big thinker who would immediately see the advantage of locating NBC on a site like Television City. Welch went on to name Bob Wright, one of his top GE executives, to head NBC, and I got the same feeling about Wright. They are exceptional men, even if they don't choose my site. At the time GE took over, NBC had been actively considering no less than 4 New York City sites, in addition to the one in New Jersey. In January 1987, NBC announced that aside from the possibility of remaining at Rockefeller Center, they'd narrowed their choice to just 2 sites, ours and the marshland owned by Hartz Mountain Industries in Secaucus, New Jersey. Eliminated from the competition were 3 other New York City sites. The result was to make the issue very simple. Either NBC came to my site, or they moved to New Jersey. The city had already announced a willingness to offer NBC tax concessions, mostly in the form of property tax abatements, as an inducement for the network to remain in New York. The question now was whether they'd offer a package competitive with New Jersey's proposal. Incredibly, the city seemed content to sit back and do nothing. I say incredible because in early 1987, Mobil Oil, one of the largest corporations in the world, announced that it was abandoning New York and moving to Virginia. A short time later, JCPenney, another huge employer, revealed that it too was leaving and taking along many thousands of jobs. You'd think the city, faced with yet a third big company threatening to leave, would spring to action. Not under Ed Koch, however. In late February 1987, the Daily News ran an editorial that I thought captured the dilemma perfectly. After suggesting that the loss of NBC would be a major blow to the city, an enormous loss of jobs, revenues, and prestige, the editorial addressed the significance of my site. Television City is far from a certainty, it said. The project must work its way through the city approval process, where anything from bureaucratic inertia to political cowardice can kill it. That's not a case for city halls blindly accepting Trump's plan in toto, but it is an argument for swiftness and efficiency in making crucial yes or no decisions. The goal of city policy must be to keep NBC home. The worst possible result would be to lose it to cowardice. In my view, that's precisely what was happening. Early in May 1987, I went to the city with a proposal for a tax abatement program that would make it possible for me to offer NBC a deal competitive with New Jersey's. Allaire Townsend, the city's head of economic development, had said herself that without abatement, NBC stood to save up to $2 billion over a 20-year period by moving to New Jersey. I suggested a deal under which I'd build NBC's headquarters myself at a cost of between $300 million and $400 million. I'd also subsidize NBC's rent for 30 years by charging only $15 a square foot, which is less than half the break-even rent. Finally, I'd agreed to give to the city 25% of any profits Television City earned for a period of 40 years. In return, I'd get a 20-year tax abatement on my entire site. Even then, my savings would begin only when I got the project up, which was years away at best. In the meantime, I'd be subsidizing NBC out of my own pocket to the tune of at least $30 million a year. Ironically, there was almost total opposition to my offer within my own organization. Robert, Harvey Freeman, and Norman Levine felt that for me to agree to give NBC $30 million a year in subsidies before we knew what revenues we'd be earning was too great a risk. My feeling was that the risk was worth taking. A tax abatement for our residential apartments would make them more marketable. In addition, NBC would be a prestigious addition to the site, and allure. For the city, it was no lose. They put up no money at all to keep NBC, and in lieu of taxes, they'd share a substantial percentage of any profits we ultimately earned. My proposal sparked the first serious negotiations we'd had with the city. Ed Koch didn't participate, but the city officials under him seemed receptive to the general structure of the plan. On May 25th, however, after more than 3 weeks of intense negotiations, Ed Koch turned the deal down cold. I'm convinced that he made the determination not on the merits, but rather because he didn't want to make any deal with me, no matter how good it was for the city. The next day, I wrote Koch a letter that I'd held off writing for more than a year. "Dear Ed," it said, "your attitude on keeping NBC in New York City is unbelievable, and I predict will lead to NBC leaving the city, as so many other major companies have, for New Jersey." I again ran down the benefits of keeping the network, and ended by saying, "I am tired of sitting back quietly and watching New Jersey and other states drain the lifeblood out of New York." Koch replied exactly the way I expected him to. He refused to respond to my specific points, and he tried to turn the issue into a personal contest of wills. Koch, the great protector against Trump, the greedy developer. For months, he'd been looking for a way to get back at me for embarrassing him by building Woolman Rink so quickly and efficiently. The West Side Yards, he apparently decided, was the perfect vehicle. When I came back with yet another suggestion for saving NBC, selling 9 acres of my site at below my cost directly to the city, Koch rejected it without so much as a discussion. I can't say I was surprised when the New York Times came out against my plan. The writer of the editorial was longtime Koch ally, Herb Sturz. Until joining the Times editorial board only a few weeks earlier, Sturz had been head of the City Planning Commission, with specific responsibility for Television City. In my view, letting Herb Sturz write editorials about New York City is analogous to permitting Caspar Weinberger to write editorials about Reagan's military policy. I did get strong editorial support, however, from the Daily News. "The mayor is correct in saying there are limits to how much the city can give NBC," the news wrote. "But that's no excuse for inaction. Koch should personally bring together the decision-makers from NBC, Rockefeller Center, and Trump's outfit. He should lay out a strong plan, and knock heads if that's what it takes." Instead, Koch offered NBC a half-assed, watered-down tax abatement proposal, which he said they could apply at any Manhattan site they chose. He even offered a little free advice about some new sites they might consider. Free advice, of course, tends to be worth what you pay for it. No sooner did Koch make his suggestion than an NBC spokesman said the network wasn't interested in considering more sites. In the meantime, the executives at Hartz Mountain Industries weren't sitting idly by. Recognizing an opportunity to force NBC's hand, they announced on June 1st that the network had 30 days to accept the terms that they were offering, and which New York was no longer willing to match. There were some who told me that I was hurting my chances for zoning approval by taking on Koch in the media. They may well have been right, but I felt there was a bigger issue at stake. I've come to believe Ed Koch is so incompetent and destructive to New York that someone has to stand up and say so publicly. When the Daily News polled its readers as to whether they agreed with Koch's position on NBC or with mine, the results were very satisfying. Nearly 10,000 readers sided with me. Only 1,800 readers went with Koch. I've waited a long time to build on the West Side, and I can wait longer to get the zoning I feel is necessary. In the end, I will build Television City with or without NBC, and with or without the current administration. I continue to keep all my other options open, too. Because, as I've said, it's the only way you truly protect yourself. If the residential real estate market remains strong, I'll undoubtedly do very well selling large Riverview apartments in that location. If the market generally falls, and that can only be temporary in a city like New York, I may choose to build only the shopping complex. I'll do very, very well just with that. My time, and Television City's, will come. I'm lucky that I can afford to wait, because that way I'll be able to do it right. The one thing I know is that I'll be doing business in New York City long after Ed Koch has moved out of Gracie Mansion. Chapter 14. The Week That Was. How the Deals Came Out. I said at the start that I'd do it to do it. But in the end, you're measured not by how much you undertake, but by what you finally accomplish. What follows is an accounting of how the deals that crossed my desk in the week I chose to describe have since turned out. Holiday Inns. Several weeks after selling my holiday steak for a profit, which was substantial, but not the reported $35 million, I began purchasing stock in another casino company, Bally Manufacturing Corporation. In a short time, I accumulated 9.9% of the stock. Bally responded by adopting poison pill provisions aimed at thwarting any attempt at a hostile takeover. When they also sued to try to keep me from buying any more stock, I countersued. 2 days after I initiated my suit, Bally announced an agreement to purchase the Golden Nugget Casino at the highest price ever for an Atlantic City casino, almost $500 million, including the cost of the bonds. Once again, the real goal seemed to be to thwart me. No company is legally permitted to own more than three casinos in Atlantic City, and if I took over Bally after they'd purchased the Golden Nugget, I'd own four. In effect, however, they put me in a win-win position. By paying such a huge price for the Nugget, Bally could only serve to increase the value of all casinos in town, including the two I already owned. In the end, Bally offered me a settlement I couldn't refuse. I agreed not to stand in the way of their purchase of the Nugget. In return, they agreed to buy back my 9.9% stake in their company at an average price much higher than I paid, giving me a profit on my brief investment of more than $20 million. In March 1987, I made my third attempt to purchase a casino company, Resorts International, but this time on a friendly basis. In the wake of the death of Resorts founder James Crosby, several other parties had launched bids for the company, but none had been successful. In the meantime, I developed a close relationship with several members of Resorts who controlled the company. In April 1987, I came to an agreement with the family to buy or tender for 93% of the voting stock in the company at $135 per share. Several other bidders subsequently offered a higher price, but the family stuck by our agreement. Among other things, they believed I was the bidder with the best credentials to complete construction on Jim Crosby's pet project, the Taj Mahal on the boardwalk. Designed as the largest and most lavish hotel casino in the world, the Taj Mahal had already gone many millions of dollars over budget and was still nowhere near completion at the time Crosby died. I hoped to have the Taj open by October 1988. In order to create a more efficient operation, I may close the casino in the existing Resorts facility adjacent to the Taj Mahal and use it to service the Taj. Of course, I could always sell it to another casino operator for the right price. Who knows? Maybe Bali or Holiday Inns might be interested. Annabelle Hill. We ended up raising more than $100,000 for the Annabelle Hill Fund, which we used to pay off her mortgage and save her farm. To celebrate, we flew Mrs. Hill and her daughter to New York, where we held Trump Tower Atrium's first, and I suspect its last, mortgage-burning ceremony. United States Football League. The owners voted unanimously to appeal the ruling under which the USFL was awarded just $1 in damages, despite the jury's antitrust finding against the National Football League. I think the grounds for an appeal are as strong as our original case. Woolman Rink. The rink came in at $750,000 under budget and opened a full month ahead of schedule in November 1986. More than 500,000 skaters enjoyed the rink during the first year. Before the opening, the city predicted a major operating loss. For the first full season of operation, we earned almost $500,000 in profits, all of which went to charity. Palm Beach Towers. Lee Iacocca became my partner in the purchase of two condominium towers in the Palm Beach area, which we bought for approximately $40 million. When we took over the project, only a few units had been sold. In a short period of time, operating in a glutted market for condominiums in southern Florida, we sold or sale leased nearly 50 units and managed to turn a bankrupt operation into a big success story. During the next year, we intend to open a major restaurant on the ground level of one of the towers. Among those who bid for the space are the owners of the 21 Club in New York and Harry Cipriani, owner of Harry's Bar. Sir Charles Goldstein was dismissed as counsel to Lee before the deal was concluded. The Australian Casino. Although we were among the finalists being considered to operate the second largest casino in the world, after the Taj Mahal in Atlantic City, I thought better of it at the last moment. The idea of running a business which is a 24-hour plane trip from New York City just didn't make sense, particularly when I have so much to occupy my attention in my own backyard. Shortly before the decision was to be announced by officials in New South Wales, I let them know that I was withdrawing my bid. The Beverly Hills Hotel. The hotel was finally sold to the highest bidder, oil man Marvin Davis, for a price far in excess of what I was willing to pay. After having the property inspected, I kept my own bid low. Of course, should Davis ever choose to sell, I'm sure he'll earn a profit. Marvin Davis subsequently became one of the bidders for Resorts International as well. After I'd already made my deal, he not only offered a higher price, but also tried to get the Murphy and Crosby families to renege on their agreement with me. They refused, and the court approved my deal, after which the New Jersey Casino Control Commission also approved it by a 5-0 vote. Right around the same time, I happened to be at a fabulous party in California thrown by Merv Adelson and Barbara Walters, and a reporter asked me about Marvin Davis's bid for resorts. Kiddingly, I said that Davis, who happens to be terribly overweight, should focus on losing 200 pounds instead of wasting time trying to break my deal with resorts. I heard later that Davis was incensed by my remark, but I can't say I felt bad. I don't go out of my way to be cordial to enemies. The parking garage. In October 1986, several months after construction on our new parking garage had begun, I got an emergency call one morning, just before I was scheduled to make a speech to a group of businessmen in New York. My construction manager, Tom Pippett, was calling. It seemed that the operator of a huge megaton crane had reached his boom out too far for a pickup, and the result was the crane and a 22-ton beam toppled over onto the garage. Pippett told me that a huge section of the garage had literally collapsed. "What about the workers?" I asked. "Was anyone hurt?" He told me that at least 100 men had been working on the site and that a headcount was underway. I told him to keep me posted and went off to make my speech, trying to put the issue out of my mind while I spoke. As I was walking out after the speech, I was handed a message from Tom. I called back immediately. "You're not going to believe this, Mr. Trump," he said, "but we've accounted for everyone and no one was hurt." Losing even one life would have been horrible and devastating. In this case, only the sheer luck that the men at the site happened to be working on another part of the garage at that moment saved their lives. It goes to show you how fragile it all really is. Those men were very lucky, and so was I. The job was finished without further incident. In May 1987, we opened 1,200 new spaces in the parking facility connected by a walkway to Trump Plaza on the boardwalk. During the week that followed, our slot machine revenues more than doubled, mostly from the increased pedestrian traffic through our facility. By July, we had all 2,700 parking spaces opened, along with a bus terminal and a limousine drop-off, all on time and on budget. Las Vegas. I withdrew my application for a gaming license in Las Vegas. Between resorts and my two other casinos in Atlantic City, I had enough to occupy me in the casino business closer to home. My focus now is on Atlantic City, but I don't rule out building or buying in Nevada at some point in the future. The Trump Car. A decision has been made to go into production on two Cadillac body limousines using my name. The Trump Golden Series will be the most opulent stretch limousine made. The Trump Executive Series will be a slightly less lavish version of the same car. Neither one has yet come off the line, but the folks at Cadillac Motors Division recently sent over a beautiful gold Cadillac Elante as a gift. Perhaps they felt I needed more toys to keep me busy. The Drexel Deal. I decided not to go forward with the hotel company deal that Drexel Burnham Lambert brought me, and I have continued to keep all my investment banking business with Alan Greenberg and Bear Stearns. It's been a rough time for Drexel. Trump's Castle. I said you can't bet against Ivana, and she proved me right even sooner than I expected. When the figures were announced for the first 3 months of 1987, Trump's Castle had the biggest increase in revenues among all of the 12 casinos in Atlantic City and was the most profitable hotel in town. The Castle took in $76.8 million in those 3 months, a 19% gain over the comparable period during the previous year. Good as that performance is, there is no way Ivana will be happy until she's far outdistanced the field. Golf and Western. I've been continuing to talk to Martin Davis, the chairman of Golf and Western, about the theaters. In addition, I've since purchased a great deal of stock in the department store chain Alexander's. The chain's flagship location between 58th and 59th Streets and 3rd and Lexington Avenues, next to Bloomingdale's, is another perfect site for theaters, as well as for a mixed-use commercial and residential skyscraper. Mar-a-Lago. The pool and the tennis court are finished, and both are as beautiful as I'd hoped they would be. As little as I'm interested in relaxing, I enjoy Mar-a-Lago almost in spite of myself. It may be as close to paradise as I'm going to get. Moscow Hotel. In January 1987, I got a letter from Yuri Dubinin, the Soviet ambassador to the United States, that began, "It is a pleasure for me to relay some good news from Moscow." It went on to say that the leading Soviet state agency for international tourism, Gostkomintourist, had expressed interest in pursuing a joint venture to construct and manage a hotel in Moscow. On July 4th, I flew with Ivana, her assistant Lisa Calandra, and Norma to Moscow. It was an extraordinary experience. We toured a half dozen potential sites for a hotel, including several near Red Square. We stayed in Lenin's suite at the National Hotel, and I was impressed with the ambition of the Soviet officials to make a deal. Trump Fund. I decided against setting up a separate fund to buy distressed real estate, using money raised from outside investors. I don't mind taking risks myself, but the idea of being responsible for the money of a lot of other people, particularly when they're bound to include some friends, just wasn't appealing in the end. For the same reason, I've never been tempted to take any of my companies public. Making choices is a lot easier when you have to answer only to yourself. My apartment. The renovation on my apartment was finally finished in the fall of 1987. I could afford to take my time, and I'm happy that I did. There may be no other apartment in the world like it. Airplane. I finally found a plane. I happened to be reading an article in Business Week in the spring of 1987 about a troubled Texas-based company named Diamond Shamrock. The article described how top Shamrock executives were enjoying incredible perks, actually living like kings. Among the examples cited was a lavishly equipped company-owned 727, which executives flew around in at will. I sensed an opportunity. On Monday morning, I called the office of the Diamond Shamrock executive who had been pictured on the cover of the Business Week article. It turned out that he was no longer there, and a new chairman, Charles Blackburn, had just been named. I was immediately put through to him. We talked for a few minutes, and I wished him well. Then I said that I'd read about the company's 727, and that if he had any interest in selling, I was interested in buying. Sure enough, Blackburn said that as much as they all loved that plane, selling it was one of the first things on his agenda. He even offered to send it up to New York, so that I could take a look at it. The next day, I went out to LaGuardia Airport for a look. I had to smile. This plane could seat up to 200 passengers, but it had been reconfigured for 15, and it included such luxuries as a bedroom, a full bath, and a separate working area. It was a little more plain than I needed, but I find it hard to resist a good deal when the opportunity presents itself. A new 727 sells for approximately $30 million. A G4, which is one-fourth the size, goes for about $18 million. However, I knew that Diamond Shamrock was hungry to sell, and that not very many people are in the market for 727s. I offered $5 million, which was obviously ridiculously low. They countered at $10 million. And at that point, I knew I had a great deal, regardless of how the negotiation ended. Still, I haggled some more, and we finally agreed on a price of $8 million. I don't believe there is any other private plane in the sky comparable to this one. What's next? Fortunately, I don't know the answer, because if I did, that would take half the fun out of it. This much I do know. It won't be the same. I've spent the first 20 years of my working life building, accumulating, and accomplishing things that many said could not be done. The biggest challenge I see over the next 20 years is to figure out some creative ways to give back some of what I've gotten. I don't just mean money, although that's part of it. It's easy to be generous when you've got a lot, and anyone who does should be. But what I admire most are people who put themselves directly on the line. I've never been terribly interested in why people give, because their motivation is rarely what it seems to be, and it's almost never pure altruism. To me, what matters is the doing, and giving time is far more valuable than just giving money. In my life, there are two things I've found I'm very good at: overcoming obstacles and motivating good people to do their best work. One of the challenges ahead is how to use those skills as successfully in the service of others as I've done, up to now, on my own behalf. Don't get me wrong. I also plan to keep making deals, big deals, and right around the clock. This is Kaleo Griffith. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Trump, The Art of the Deal, by Donald J. Trump, with Tony Schwartz. This program was directed by Dave Kephart and Scott Sherritt. Producer, Juliana Wilson. Text copyright 1987 by Donald J. Trump. Production copyright 2016. Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.